From Carol McKenney Public Media in Oviedo, Florida, it's Central Florida Matters.
It's difficult. It's a difficult time for families. These families have taken care of themselves for years, and then all of a sudden they find they have no jobs, and they have no food, and they have no gas money to get to a job. It's difficult.
They should judge the future candidate on how they perceive them from a leadership ability, how they perceive them as far as their integrity and their ethics, then what they should expect from them if they are elected, that they immediately get themselves trained up.
The road here, a road through Wagner, my great-great-grandfather helped laid the road because it was a brick road. So on up the road, I don't know, but the brick may be still under the asphalt.
Welcome to Central Florida Matters. I'm Stephen McKinney Stack.
And I'm Desta Horner. To those of us who live, work, and raise our families here, Central Florida matters.
And within Central Florida, there are issues and voices that matter too, like those you just heard, which we'll be featuring on this, the September 17th, 2009 posting of Central Florida Matters.
This program is posted in its full length from now until September 22nd, when the individual features of this program will be posted separately so that you can easily listen to the feature in which you have an interest.
Those features and this complete program will remain on the homepage for a three-week period until the next Central Florida Matters is posted, at which point the complete program and the individual features will move to the archive section of the website for you to access anytime. In the archive, you'll find the features placed in topic categories, or you may simply search for topics by inputting keywords.
What are the issues and voices of this edition of Central Florida Matters?
A primer on voting smart in the November 3rd municipal elections, a look back on the history of one of our local communities, and we hear voices on the street from the first days of school to celebrating the 222nd anniversary of the signing of the Constitution of the United States, plus commentary from the chair of the governing board of CMF. Though coming now, we hear how a local food pantry is coping with the economy in Seminole County.
According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, more than 35 million people in the United States are currently receiving food stamps. That's an increase of 700,000 since May. The average household of four receives $293 worth of food stamps per month. As the jobless rate and the foreclosure rate stay high, more and more people turn to food pantries to close the gap between what they can afford and what they need. Food pantries are on the front line of assisting people in financial trouble to put food on the table. The Sunshine Food Pantry, located on East Broadway in Oviedo, is sponsored by the Hope Foundation, a nonprofit charity. How is this pantry coping with the pressure of meeting the needs of their clients? Clients who are trying to cope with an economy in recession. Susan Levy, a coordinator of the Sunshine Food Pantry, describes its operation and its challenges during this crucial time.
My name is Susan Levy. I'm the coordinator of the food pantry at Sunshine Pantry. We're open Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, basically from around 10:30, 11 to 2 o'clock. So far, when I first started here, we were doing 28 families a day. We're up to 75. And the strange thing is that I took a count on how many new families we had last month. We had 46 new families come in, which is really high. Like I say, I turn no one away. It's the size of the family of what kind of food they receive here. When you're 1 to 3 in a family, we'll give them 5 canned goods and 2 dry goods, which includes cereal or flour or pasta. If it's a larger family, from 4 and up to 6, we give them 8 canned goods and we give them 3 dry goods. And the only thing special about us is that we let our clients go through and they pick out their own foods. We do not bag it because I feel that if we bag it, they might not like half of what's in the bag, and they'll just throw it away, and it's a waste. Plus, it gives us the contact with these people. We talk to them. We listen to them. Sometimes we hug a lot. Sometimes we cry a lot. But I think the idea of walking through with them and talking to them is, I think it's much warmer. It's very difficult for families to come in and ask for help. I've been there. When my kids were little, I was really roughing it out, and it's very hard to ask for help. We had one young lady come in today, and she was in tears.
She just didn't know how to confront us and ask for help. So we talked to her for a while, and then we gave her a box of food and bread and desserts. She'll come back weekly. If she has a hard time doing it, we'll help them as much as we can to get over it. A lot of families don't come back because it's very, very uncomfortable for them. It's difficult. It's a difficult time for families. These families have taken care of themselves for years, and then all of a sudden they find they have no jobs, and they have no food, and they have no gas money to get to a job. It's difficult.
Large food banks like Second Harvest distribute millions of pounds of food to thousands of food pantries throughout Florida. There it is distributed to individuals and families. But most of the pantry's supplies come from local donations and food drives by schools and churches.
Right now we're really, really low on donations. School's getting back, so we're going to have food drives. The churches are, people are coming back from vacation, so we have to, like, October, November, the food will, we're hoping that will start coming in. UCF has drives for us. All the elementary schools, they do. Some of the private schools have it. We'll hit anybody up that we can get to help us. Like right now, we get food from Second Harvest. We go down, I drive down once a week and load up the cars and the vans, and we bring the food back. But the donations are down. Christina and I are going, we're going to start going around to the schools and setting up food drives. And so this way, like every month or every 2 months, we're getting at least one food drive coming in, large, small. People walk in with just a bag of, like a gentleman just came in a few minutes ago. He says, I'm bringing you some juices. Terrific. I'll take it. We use everything, anything that anybody wants to donate, we will take, and it will not go to waste here. I mean, diapers, desperate for diapers. Very bad. These young girls come in with these babies. They can't put diapers on them. It breaks my heart. Sometimes we get a lot of vegetables. We pick up from grocery stores. Albertsons, big help. Publix gives us their bread and their desserts. Let me see where else we get help. Popeyes gives us their leftovers. Farmers come in sometimes when they have an abundance of corn or apples or what, oranges. Oh, when that season comes, I'm looking forward to it because they bring us boxes and boxes, and we let the people take what they need.
Chris and our young daughter, Grace, come to the Sunshine Food Pantry once a week to pick up food that will supplement their grocery budget. Chris has a positive attitude and a heart full of gratitude to help her cope. Chris, you've come to the food pantry. Why are you here?
Well, just to supplement our food. We're hand to mouth, rob Peter to pay Paul. And it really makes a difference, just that little extra food, you know, because our budget for groceries a week is small, very small.
What advice would you give to others who are in your same position about handling this situation, coming to the food bank, whatever?
Be as creative as you can. Go to garage sales, go to thrift stores, take your clothes to consignment, go trash picking and sell it on Craigslist. I mean, I do all those. I actually will go trash picking. I don't actually get in the dumpster. I go to like your nicer neighborhoods, and I've found like an arbor, a swing for our swinging bench. I found a dog crate that I turned around and sold for $20 on Craigslist. So, you know, it's a little extra effort, but it does help. Oh, there's some gas money, or okay, now I can get Grace this, or something like that. So you got to be very creative. Use what you have, give it a facelift, turn off the lights, keep your air conditioning at 80, you know. And so that's how we're doing it. It's just one day at a time.
How do you handle the stress?
Well, when you got Jesus in your heart, he's a provider, and he gives provision, and it's just, there is a supernatural peace. It does get worrisome at time because the daycare is very expensive. I mean, it almost doesn't pay for me to go to work, but I love what I do. I actually work with the homeless, and there is stress, but you just suck it up and get through the day and just show as much love you can and concentrate on your children. You know, sometimes having nothing isn't a bad thing. And there's a lot of simple pleasures. So I don't really get stressed too much anymore. I used to, even though it's, if you knew what we make and what our bills are, it'd be like, oh. It's like we are in the red every month.
So the people here, how do they treat you at the food pantry?
Wonderful. They're sweethearts. There's no condemnation, you know. I mean, nobody's judged, you know. There's no condemnation. They don't question your situation because you really wouldn't be here unless there was a need. Because if you really didn't have a need, you'd be like, I ain't going to the food pantry. So I think they realize even though people have decent cars and are dressed nice, you know, they're really good to us. They're not snotty. They don't make you feel bad because you got to come here. And Chrissy, you saw, she gave me a hug. So, you know, I don't mind coming here. I've been coming here for 2 years, and I am grateful. I truly, truly am.
You know, one thing about Hope is that this is not a glamorous place to be.
Oh, far from it. It's hot. We just got air conditioning around 6 months ago, and it really doesn't cool off the whole place, so it gets really brutal in there sometimes. But you know what? I have a great group of people that come in and help me. Without them, there would be no way this pantry would be running. They are awesome. They come in, they put their time. Without these people, without the volunteers, there'd be no pantry.
As job losses mount, the pantry has noticed more men coming to get food. The homeless come by and are given tents and food with easy opening tops to use as they camp in the woods. Many times clients come to the pantry with more problems than can be solved with a bag of food. The volunteers try to provide help of all kinds. Susan Levy tells this story of one young woman having a hard time coping.
We had a young girl come in. I'll call her Sarah. She has two babies at home. Her husband had just lost his job after working for like 7 years. So they were really deep in debt. No car, no phone. Everything was being turned off left and right on them. She came to us one day for food by bus, crying. We gave her food. We gave her a list of places to call. You try to get them a phone, you know, like with $10 on it so they can make calls, you know, to look for work. I gave her a bus pass so she could actually come here or go looking for a job. But sometimes they get so beaten down and they get so lost with not being able to survive or how to feed their children that they don't leave the house. They just can't face it. Because a week or two later, we asked, did you go looking for a job? I can't do it. She just couldn't do it. I don't know what happened. If I was a religious person, I'd say God came down to help her. He found a job. They're going to give him a car to use. She looks wonderful. You can see her whole life is in her eyes again. But she still hurts. She still needs help with the food and I mean, a lot of the people are good stories. They go get jobs and they disappear. And sometimes they get jobs and they still need help. They still need that extra $30 a week to get canned goods or bread.
How do you feel about when all is said and done? When you go home with some of the sad stories, you feel some...
I hurt, but I go home with a good feeling and I'm tired. And it's a good tired because... I don't want to sound sappy or anything, that you know, that you help people and all that, but I listen to their stories, and if I have to hug one or they have to hug me, hey, I go home with a smile on my face.
At the food pantry, each bag of food comes with a bag of hope and a smile. For Central Florida Matters, this is Desta Horner.
Come on, darling. Good morning. How are you?
Desta, I'm curious. As Susan, the coordinator of the pantry, said, the pantry simply wouldn't operate without the volunteers. What motivates them to work so hard?
Well, Steve, I think it's a sense of purpose, of doing something meaningful. Even high school students put in hours at food pantries, and they're earning their Bright Futures scholarship service requirements. And many churches and civic organizations regularly donate their time and, of course, their food products in food drives. And we've posted additional information about the food pantry on our website at cmfmedia.org. There you'll also find helpful links to other sites relative to this topic. You'll be able to see some pictures that were taken during the interview, too.
And leave a comment on the site or email the piece to a friend, a family member, or a colleague if you know they will have an interest in coping with the economy in Seminole County. Late August and early September in cities around Central Florida, we hear happy voices and sounds of kids and teachers returning to school after summer break. The sound of these young voices and attendant clamor were recorded with permission at Lawton Elementary School in Oviedo and at Oviedo High School. Voices range from those in the cafeteria to the car line, from the crossing guard at a busy intersection to the slamming of book lockers in the hallway, and from a football scrimmage to the practice of a marching band. Listen, can you identify each of them?
Okay, boys and girls, I need one head behind the other. One head behind the other. On the line, right there. Very good.
Chance Randall.
Now you can
play. Eliza, number 4. Rachel Porter, number 5.
Was it good? Yeah. Did you have PE?
Uh-huh.
And what did you do?
Play volleyball, but we called it throwing trash in our neighborhood.
Okay. Was it fun?
Yeah.
School can start at 12 o'clock and end at 12:02. That'll be the best thing in the world.
It ended at 3, but it still started at nine.
I wish they had better PE games.
Yeah, like Capture the Ruby.
And no. We'll go home and drink a Coke.
Yeah.
Yeah, you better pay me some money for that.
Hey, Kevin. How's it going? You doing good, Kevin?
Hey, Renner.
Blaine Smith.
Renner pal.
Really focus on keeping tempo.
Voices in the huddle. This is Stephen McKinney Stack for Central Florida Matters.
Sally. You read Goofy 25 Sally. On two, on two. Ready?
Ready!
Voices on the Street is a recurring sound montage on Central Florida Matters. If you know of a community location or an oral theme illustrative of your neighborhood or a time of year or a particular subject, the sounds of which evoke a place in time, let us know. Click on the contact link and advise us with an email. From Carol McKinney Foundation for Public Media in Oviedo, Florida, you're listening to Central Florida Matters. I'm Desta Horner.
And I'm Stephen McKinney Stack. Thanks for listening and visiting cmfmedia.org, your online portal to issues and voices that matter in Central Florida. While at the site, we encourage you to read or subscribe to the CMF e-letter and our upcoming blog, Issues and Voices.
Plus, you can download the audio podcast of this complete program or listen to it via online streaming. There's also a provision to email us directly with your comments or post your comments online for all to read about the program or any of the segments.
Oh, and by the way, we do moderate the comments, so there will be a slight delay before yours will be posted. And while you're on the site, please email the link of the program to a friend, a colleague, or a family member.
Still to come on this edition of Central Florida Matters is a primer on voting smart in the November 3rd municipal elections. And we hear Voices on the Street celebrating the 222nd anniversary of the signing of the Constitution of the United States, plus commentary from the chair of the governing board of CMF about issues and voices.
The election season is upon us, or at least so in the Seminole County cities of Longwood and Oviedo. They are the only cities to step out with candidates to elect for city office on Tuesday, November 3rd. Here on Central Florida Matters, we're making plans to speak with each candidate in the weeks to come. Yet before we present the candidates and their platforms to you, we're thinking it's time to first be sure we become smart voters prior to casting our vote at the polls. We start this process now in a recurring feature we're going to call Voting Smart. To offer a bit of advice to we voters seeking to be voting smart, we turn to a former 6-year elected city official, the one with the most recent experience, but with no dog in the hunt. We asked him to give us a few suggestions as to how best we should judge candidates for city office. We also asked him to offer his perspective on the challenges cities and candidates may be facing. Along the way, in response to a few questions we posed, he offers some additional and unique advice to incumbents and candidates alike.
My name is Tom Walders.
Walters is a 61-year-old retired U.S. Air Force colonel, having served 28 years in officer positions, most recently as vice commander of the 62nd Airlift Wing at McChord Air Force Base in Tacoma, Washington.
So that was a fairly challenging position, and I retired from that position in February of 2000, wherein we moved here to Oviedo, Florida. I became active in some civic organizations, I'll call them. When the mayor at that time chose not to run for re-election, I was approached about taking running for that position since I was, quote, retired and had the time. That was in 2001. September of 2001, I was elected at large from the city and served a two-year term and ran twice more for re-election for two more two-year terms. So I served for a total of 6 years, from 2001 to through December of 2007.
Does Oviedo have term limits?
They do not. However, Tom Walters has term limits, and 6 years was enough. So I chose not to run for re-election in 2007.
Former Mayor Tom Walters' six-year term of service gave him and his city council members a fairly unprecedented period of success, growth, and prosperity. Walters served as mayor in the fourth largest city out of seven cities in Seminole County. With a population in 2007 of 32,000 residents, Walters' timing could not have been better in leaving office just before evidence was being encountered of a challenging economic recession looming over the county and the cities. His six-year term in office lent itself well to many of our questions kicking off our Voting Smart series. In what you'll hear in a wide-ranging interview covering media, ethics, and the Sunshine Law, to name just a few, we first ask former Mayor Walters to set the scene for what candidates and voters face on this road to voting smart.
Given that 6 or 7 years of experience of leadership, running for office, dealing with other members who ran for office, dealing with the voting constituency, give us sort of your perspective on what you think is in store for the city of Oviedo's or adjoining cities over the next 3 to 5 years.
That's very easy to answer. Budget challenges. With the reduction in property taxes over the past couple of years, and with the population growth going in a negative direction, the revenue is not there. Our city, the city of Oviedo, as well as the surrounding cities and the county, are all facing significant budget challenges.
What's the second issue besides the challenges of the budget that you would say the cities have in store over the next 3 or 5 years?
I would say maintaining services. This past year, Oviedo was recognized as one of the top 100 cities in the United States. And they didn't put us in a particular position. They just said, you're in the top 100. We got there because of services and the way we treat our families and the population in general. And so to come up with creative ways to maintain that level of lifestyle with reduced revenue is going to be, I think, the second challenge.
To the uninitiated but well-intended and well-motivated candidate for office, is this not a good time to stand for election or re-election?
Most of the folks that are in office are somewhat addicted to it. I'll put it that way.
So their addiction leads them to standing for election in spite of common sense or better judgment?
That's exactly it. On the other hand, the candidates that I have met are motivated because they think they can do it better. Even though it's not a good time to be in office, they think that they can do more with less, better than the incumbents. So that's typically what motivates them. But as you said, right now, common sense and reality would back me away from the elected positions.
Do you suspect candidates understand that that's what's in store for them in terms of more intense concentration on management, leadership, and dealing with lean times than they might imagine?
I had no concept of the reality of some of the issues, and I don't think that the candidates today are any smarter about them than I was 7 or 8 years ago.
Are you suggesting that most candidates, and we're not trying to identify any, we're not trying to identify cities, we're just saying municipal candidates, are or are not prepared for office?
I would say they are not.
And is that any different from the candidates or yourself that surrounded you when you were running for office?
No, it's no different. And again, I'll use myself. I thought after 28 and a half years in the military, serving as a senior leader of large organization, that if anybody was ready to step into something such as the mayor's job, I was it. It took me 3 to 6 months to really figure out what I was doing. From observing on the outside, I did not have the full visibility of what all was required. And it's true of the candidates today.
It was true of you, you said.
Yeah,
too.
It was true of me.
If, admittedly, knowing the kind of issues you're going to have to deal with aren't necessarily in your tool bag of experiences, and if a citizen or a voter, one and the same, understands that, how should they judge you? Or how should they judge future candidates?
Well, they should judge the future candidate on how they perceive them from a leadership ability, how they perceive them as far as their integrity and their ethics. Then what they should expect from them, if they are elected, that they immediately get themselves trained up.
During candidate meetings with voters, what are the range of questions that make a candidate or an incumbent standing for election go, uh-oh, this is the big one?
It wasn't always, uh-oh, but it was a showstopper, is when I was asked my opinion about one of my opponents. And I personally did not want to answer that. That's for the audience to decide for themselves, not for me as the opponent.
Are candidates, do they come into their candidacy or their tendency to want to stand for re-election with that kind of wisdom to not answer those kind of questions?
Most have the wisdom not to answer those kind of questions.
And you would still advocate for maintaining that wisdom? Or is that the kind of thing that you think today's society says, look, you're the candidate or you're the incumbent standing for re-election, we want to know X, Y, Z?
Well, if it's about another candidate, I'm absolutely just not going to answer it. Now, if it's about an issue, I feel that it's my obligation to provide an answer.
Imagine that you've been invited to a room full of candidates for city or municipal office to offer them advice and counsel. Well, what three things would you advise candidates?
Well, first of all, always be honest. I have seen too many candidates and some elected officials that want to be popular. And so therefore they'll say the popular thing rather than the right thing. Next of all is be prepared. Now, third thing is just listen to the people. Get out amongst the people. Listen to whether you agree with it or not. Interact with the population.
What if that same seating arrangement was we removed the candidates, but we replaced them with the voters? Now you're speaking to the voters. What three things do you tell, in your experienced position, voters to be mindful of when they cast their ballot?
Well, I think you could use the same three things. What do you think of the candidate ethically? Do you think the candidate has demonstrated that he's prepared? And has the candidate been out amongst the population and interacted?
We've had voters to whom you're speaking. We're going to change the room out and bring in the spouses of candidates. What advice would you offer spouses of candidates?
Grow thick skin. I can't say it any clearer than that. My wife was not prepared for some of the barbs that were thrown at me. And because she's very supportive, she would typically see things in the same perspective as I would. So to her, those were oftentimes hurtful. And so she, quite frankly, would fret about them more than I would. You know, it was one of the considerations for me not running for election anymore.
What advice do you give to candidates about dealing with the ethics and standards in office?
As soon as you define the attributes, give it a finite definition, then you kind of build a fence around it, and anything that falls outside that fence line is not included. And so it's when I talk about ethics, is it's just a high character level, high moral lifestyle in everything that a candidate says and does. It's hard to put a fence around it. What all has to be included and what should be excluded? I tell candidates that they just have to demonstrate the highest values they can in all ways of life and what they do and what they say.
Given the Sunshine Law and the restrictions, as I understand it, of communication, elected official to elected official without the public or the media being present, how do you go about, and what advice would you offer to candidates, building relationships with your co-elected officials?
Well, I would advise them, first of all, to learn about the Sunshine Law, because there is a lot of misnomers on the Sunshine Law. I can talk 5 or 6 hours a day with a fellow elected official about our son's volleyball game or baseball game, and there's no violation of the Sunshine. But as soon as I start talking about remodeling the ballpark where they're playing that game, which is an issue that may come up before council, then we're violating the Sunshine.
So anything that comes or is contemplated to come before council is restricted in terms of a dialogue other than in a public forum?
That's correct.
Does that also extend to your...
And it has to be a public forum that has been previously posted. What a candidate needs to do is become knowledgeable on what the Sunshine Law actually says and doesn't say.
Let me take you back to that room full of candidates again.
Sure.
And you've been brought in as the expert consultant to offer your advice and perspective based upon the experience you've had. They want to know what the good experiences they might encounter along the way of their election process, their term of service, and then after they retire. What are the good parts about being the elected official in a city?
Well, the best part about being a candidate is election day night, because it's over.
Whether you win or not?
Whether you win or not. It's only better if you win.
So you would tell them that, right?
I would tell them that. I think a lot of the election process I did not enjoy. However, the one thing I did enjoy was the debates. If they were formatted correctly, I found them to be very telling and just a good environment to hear what the candidates and the incumbents had to say.
So you would encourage them to look forward to debates?
And I would.
Embrace them. What else? What about after office?
After office?
After their term expires or they lose the next round of reelection.
I would say it's the recognition. For me, it's been the recognition I get in the community. While you're in office, it's about affecting change.
Let's segue to media. On a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being terrific, how would you rate the media's coverage of city government of Oviedo or the cities in the East Seminole County region?
I would say that the media's coverage is probably somewhere between a 2 and a 3.
Rising or falling?
Staying even. I mean, it's on a plateau. In the Central Florida region, Orlando and Orange County are the center of the universe for everything that happens media-wise.
What advice would you give to candidates in how they could structure an appropriate relationship with media, whatever appropriate means in your mind's eye?
That also will be a learning curve.
What advice do you give on the curve, though?
Okay, is to be responsive to the media.
Does the candidate's relationship with the media change once that candidate is elected? And if so, what advice would you give that candidate to manage that change?
Answering the first half of that, yes, absolutely it changes. What changed is when you're in office, especially as the mayor, they wanted to know what I was thinking about various issues or various situations.
Where don't they go far enough?
I don't think they go far enough, especially in terms of a smaller city in this environment where there's a large city just down the highway, is they don't go far enough in covering what's going on in a smaller community.
Does their business model allow for that? Does their mission allow for that?
It probably doesn't. And yes, I am well aware of that. Where are they going to get the advertisers? Where are they going to get the income stream and that? And it isn't going to come from a small city. It's going to come from the bigger city.
Former six-year Mayor Tom Walters, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're more than welcome. I hope I shed some light on the intricacies of being an elected official.
For Central Florida Matters, this is Stephen McKinney Steck.
Steve, a couple of questions about your interview with Mayor Tom Walters. He seemed to be pretty candid with you.
Yeah, I think his candor allowed him to state pretty freely and confidently that he simply thought he wasn't as prepared as he thought he would be to run for office. Then he also went on to suggest that that he didn't really think that now was a good time to stand for election on one level, but it is a good time if you've got that leadership fire in the belly. And then he seemed a bit bemused that newcomer candidates always think they have the right answers when previous elected officials like him and others were simply stymied or stumped in terms of a resolution they tried to bring to the issue.
What do you think we're going to learn in the excerpts from your extended interview with Walters?
He raises two issues that we did not pursue in the feature we just heard that are on the extended interviews. One is the issue of training for candidates. You'll remember he said candidates need to get trained up as soon as they were elected. There's a whole piece in the excerpts about what that kind of training would be, though interestingly, the training is only available after you're elected. There doesn't seem to be apparent training for candidates. And then also on the extended excerpts, he is somewhat surprised about how few candidates approach him or other elected officials to serve as mentors, which frankly does seem to be a surprising lack of use of an asset like former Mayor Walters and others who have served well for the city. No one ever seems to approach them. In the end, though, he offers advice to voters as well as candidates that makes both camps able to vote more smartly and maybe at least one camp to run for office more smartly. We'll be posting additional information about the municipal elections coming up on November 3rd in Oviedo and Longwood on our website at cmfmedia.org, where you'll also find helpful links to other sites relative to the topic. And as you heard us say, we'll also be posting excerpts from the full interview with former Oviedo Mayor Tom Walters, as well as being able to show you some more pictures we took during the interview.
And please leave a comment or email this piece to a friend, family member, or colleague if you know they have an interest in voting smart.
September 17th, 1787, 222 years ago, a document was signed containing a 52-word preamble to a remarkable 4,400-word document known simply as the Constitution of the United States. It created the present form of government of our country by establishing three branches of government, which are the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branch. It also contains the Bill of Rights and other amendments, which establishes the basic rights of all American citizens. The day this edition of Central Florida Matters was posted online is called Constitution Day, September 17th, marking the anniversary of the day the Constitution was signed by 39 delegates to the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. 222 years later, we went to the Oviedo Shopping Center in search of voices on the street to hear the preamble of the Constitution spoken by our neighbors, and we gave each voice a bit of a civics test while we were there. I'd like you to read a phrase from this card, and then I'll list four possible choices from which that phrase came, and I want you to pick from among those four what you think that phrase came from.
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union.
Now tell me, was that phrase from either the Star-Spangled Banner, the Pledge of Allegiance, the Constitution of the United States, or the Declaration of Independence?
Declaration of Independence.
Are you certain of that?
Relatively certain.
Okay.
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union.
Now then, it came from one of these four or five. It's the motto of the United Autos Workers Union. It's from the Gettysburg Address. It's from the United States Constitution. It's from the Bill of Rights. Or it's from the Presidential Oath of Office. Which is it?
The second one.
Gettysburg Address?
Yeah, I think it is.
Bill of Rights.
Constitution? I wanted to say Bill of Rights.
That's your last choice?
The Constitution.
You're right, it's the Constitution.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union.
Now, Clark, did that come from the Star-Spangled Banner, the Pledge of Allegiance, the Constitution of the United States, or the Declaration of Independence?
Declaration of Independence.
Or is it from the Star-Spangled Banner, or the Pledge of Allegiance, or the Declaration of Independence?
Oh, that'd be the Declaration of Independence.
You're certain, Larry?
No, but that's what I'm going with.
Constitution.
You're certain?
Yes.
You want to say maybe that's from the Gettysburg Address, or the Bill of Rights, or the Presidential Oath of Office?
We the people. Geez, I kept thinking Constitution. Gettysburg. It's not the Gettysburg. So what was the other option?
The United Auto Workers Union motto?
No, I don't think so.
The Bill of Rights or the Presidential Oath of Office? It could have been from the Star-Spangled Banner.
No, I don't think so either. What was the other one? I'm sorry.
Gettysburg Address. Presidential Oath of Office. Well, you are correct all along. I was just pushing the test. Thank you very much. Well done.
We the people of the United States,
in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility,
provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings
and liberties to ourselves and to our prosperity,
do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Preceded by voices from the street, here at the Oviedo Shopping Center on the 222nd anniversary of the September 17th, 1787 signing of the United States Constitution. This is Stephen McKinney Stack for Central Florida Matters.
You're listening to Central Florida Matters from Carol McKinney Public Media. I'm Desta Horner, joined again by Stephen McKinney Steck.
Thanks for visiting cmfmedia.org, your online portal to Central Florida issues and voices that matter. We encourage you to subscribe to the CMF e-letter and also to Issues and Voices, the CMF blog, still under construction.
Playing off under construction, on the next posting of Central Florida Matters, which is set for Thursday, October 8th, we're constructing the next Voting Smart feature, where you'll meet and hear candidates from the Oviedo and Longwood city elections.
And depending on the length of the candidate interviews, we may also post the results of a new feature we title On Being, and then you fill in the blank, like On Being Homeless in Seminole County, or On Being Gay in Seminole County, or On Being Single, or Hospitalized, or Hispanic, or On Being Adopted. Got it?
Or we may post the next History of Our Communities feature, perhaps this one on the community of Taintsville.
Whoa, Taintsville? Where or what is Taintsville?
Well, here's a hint. It taint Chuliota and it taint Oviedo.
Well, all right. Hear that and more on the next Central Florida Matters online Thursday, October 8th at cmfmedia.org.
While on the website, consider subscribing to the content using the RSS feature we provide for your feed reader, or use iTunes. Either way, though, once subscribed, you'll be alerted immediately to each new piece we produce and post.
And when you subscribe to the CMF e-letter, as we have been suggesting, or subscribe to the blog, they will also remind you the moment it's posted and will also preview some of the material with you in those two platforms. Now, coming up in just a few moments, CMF Board Chair Judy Duda offers comments about issues and voices that matter to her as part of our ongoing commentary feature. But next, Desta launches a new feature, The History of Our Communities, with a look back on the history of little-known community called Wagner.
Now, Mexico City's buildings rest on the ruins of the Aztec civilization. Southern supermarkets are built on Civil War battlefields. And here in Central Florida, many of our subdivisions, roads, and schools sit on Indian council grounds, settlers' homesteads, and the fields and groves that fed the United States in the first half of the 20th century. East Seminole County has one of those hidden historical treasures. On August 22nd, the Seminole Historical Commission dedicated the first historical marker in Winter Springs. It marks the location of the town of Wagner. Never heard of Wagner? It's under your tires as you drive on State Road 434, and under your feet as you play baseball at Central Winds Park or conduct business at City Hall. This area, from the shores of Lake Jessup to Howell Branch Creek, has a deep history. It may be invisible to the eye, but it is still alive in the memories of some citizens of Seminole County. At the dedication for the new marker for Wagner, I spoke to several members of the Seminole County Historical Commission as we sat near the marker on State Road 434. First, Ed LaRue, a member of the Historical Commission, gives us a picture of the earliest period of settlements in the area.
You know, Tuscarawas Road at the end had a wharf, and Lake Jessup was more shallow than Lake Monroe, and the ships that were on the St. John's couldn't really get in here too easily. But the shallow draft ship could come in with some goods, and Tuscarawas Road was an old Indian trail, as well as some others around here. Howell Creek, just beyond that, had an old wooden bridge built in the 1870s. And a man was commissioned by the name of O'Brien to put the pilings down with power things that were driven by hand on Howell Creek, because these citizens that lived in present-day Slavia and Oviedo, about 90 people lived there in the 1880s, would have to come to the end of Tuscarawas Road to the wharf to get their foodstuffs. You know, their bacon, their beans, their flour, their sugar, their salt, this kind of thing. And they could not get across Howell Creek because it was so sharply banked. The horses could not get down and back up. So a bridge went in, and the man came out and camped, because he was home-based in Orlando. He camped for 2 months with helpers in white tents and would work from Monday to Friday, and then they would go by horseback into Orlando for the weekend and come back out here. It was so long to travel. The pilings are still there. It was built in 1876, 11 years after the Civil War.
Sometimes events don't reach the high standards of historical research, but make for a great story about the region.
Now, a farmer on a tractor about a half a mile west of here hit something, a clunk-clunk in the ground, turning over soil, went down to investigate and found the remnants of a breastplate and a helmet. And this was so intriguing because the DeSoto came through here about 40 miles west of here in the 1500s. Now, I can't verify this. Supposedly, the helmet was decayed and rusted and broken. The breastplate was just evidence of the Spanish army coming through here. Now, the thing that makes it possibly plausible is that the line of cypress trees on the south end of Lake Jessup going to Soldiers, across Soldiers Creek and where the Big Tree Park is today, was the most prominent stand of cypress in Florida. We know that the Indians had council here. It's just possible that some of the Indians knew of DeSoto's passage and interacted with him and led some of his party over here and maybe slaughtered them, killed the man, took the things of his body and buried them. Now, that's possible. I don't want to start a rumor, but it's an intriguing story. I cannot verify it.
Cecil Tucker, the vice president of the Seminole Historical Commission, was the county agricultural agent during the years when Seminole County was the celery and cabbage center of the United States. Half a century ago, he watched as acres of produce were grown and shipped to northern markets each winter.
I came into Seminole County in 1956 as Seminole County Agricultural Agent. Because this was farm area out here, I had a lot of memories, a lot of dealings with the farmers out here in the Wagner area. In those days, it was just a two-lane road till you got to the sharp curve. At that sharp curve, on the north side of the road was the railroad track, and they used to load cabbage and celery. But on the south side of the highway, that farm stayed operational for a good many years after the rest of them. They grew primarily cabbage.
Do you remember who were the people that worked the farm?
Well, the farm workers, since the people that was farming here headquartered in Sanford, many of the farm workers actually was part of their crew in Sanford, but there was some that came from Oviedo here. But basically, the black workers in both areas. worked here on these farms. The thing that was different in this area is that we had subterranean irrigation. There was tile about 24 inches, 18, 24 inches below the surface, that the water came into that tile from artesian wells. And that system acted both as a irrigation and a drainage system. At the end of the line, they could plug it up, put the water in, and make the water level or rise in the fields. After a big rain like we've been getting lately, they pull those plugs out and it would drain it out.
There are few residents of Wagner around today, but Walter Hendricks grew up in Wagner. Mr. Hendricks is 69 and has owned Hendricks Antiques and Furniture Restoration of Oviedo for 45 years. His mother worked in the fields that Cecil Tucker has just described.
All of the farm area, big farm area, they raise pepper, cabbage, corn. The people come from different places to work on the farm, but my mother and my aunt were study workers there. I remember that farm so vivid. They had the big pocket holes, what were called manholes. They would stop up different areas to water different areas of the farm where they use irrigation now on top. The irrigation was underground then. And matter of fact, all of those tiles are still underground up there in that subdivision.
What was your mother's day like as a worker on the farm?
Up early, work to noon, and then she would come home for dinner. Well, they had a big bell on the farm that they rang to let them know that it was time to stop for dinner and then time to go back to work. They worked to 5 o'clock.
What kind of work was it?
It was hoeing the plants. When they planted the cabbage, she would ride that setting machine and place the plant in the slot, which the machine would then put it in the ground and cover it. In time for harvesting, she participated in the harvesting also. I was always out in the fields with her and running up and down the roads, but never worked in the field, me and my brother. But they would bring in the crews from Sanford and the surrounding area and let them harvest the crop. The train come from Sanford, and they would fill the car boxes with the produce and take it away. I remember there in Wagner, there was a depot. They had two mules on the farm, gray mule and a brown mule. I don't remember the name, but the gray mule would always get out. In that depot, they would ship in hay for the mule. Well, the hay was always a peanut hay. Me and my brother would all love to climb up in the hay and pick the little peanuts out of it.
Those boys in the peanut hay enjoyed the fun, but had school and chores to do as well.
I started school at a one-room church school that was from first to eighth grade. It served as a church on Sunday, and the school starts on Monday. And the school was located where the Winter Springs City Hall is right now. On the farm, I remember, my mother would tell me, I want you to have supper cooked when I come. She didn't say what. We had a four-burner wood stove, the oven placed on the side you put the wood in, and a place up top where you stored for warm food. And at 6 years old, I had to gather wood, start the fire, and put the food on. I had a wooden stool about a foot and a half. You look at me now, you wouldn't believe it, but I was just a little bitty teeny thing. And I would have to get up on that stool and look in the pot to see what was what. And when my mother come home, must have been good because they ate it. They ate it like it was a gourmet meal. I don't ever remember getting sick. I remember I got a cut. My brother cut me with a cabbage knife. And it must have hit an artery vessel because it was pumping blood. And my mother was gone, so I run to my aunt's house. And she reached up in the corner and grabbed a handful of spider web and put it on that cut. And it went, turned off just like a faucet. That's things people don't know today.
Probably the most singular aspect of Wagner was the famous Dead Man's Curve. This dangerous 90-degree turn in the road between Longwood and Oviedo was eliminated by the engineers when State Road 434 was modernized. Commission member Ed LaRue remembers it well.
When my kids also went to Oviedo High School, and during their time there, they graduated in the 80s, there were two or three fatalities from the Wagner Curve, absolutely.
Walter Hendricks witnessed a deadly accident on that curve.
It was just like a horseshoe. It was a terrible curve. There was a pickup truck, had 7 or 8 men on it, going to the orange grove. And the young man that was driving the truck was driving real fast. This particular day, we was walking up there, and this truck passed with all these men on it. When it got to the curve, it just flipped, bottom up. And after they pulled all the men out, there was one man under the truck dead. Dead man's curve. It was dangerous.
The new historic marker by the side of the road near that once dangerous curve reminds us that there's a history beneath our feet. Visit the Historical Society in your community to learn more. For Central Florida Matters, this is Desta Horner.
Dead Man's Curve. Do you remember that, Desta?
Oh, I sure do, Steve. I drove that road often through the 1970s. That area was mainly orange groves or fields, so that at night it was very dark. And, of course, it only had 2 lanes. You had to watch carefully for headlights approaching from the other direction as warning and slow down.
My own observations suggest that area has really changed a lot in a relatively short time.
It certainly has. Winter Springs is celebrating its 50th anniversary, and it has reshaped the entire landscape of that area dramatically. Mr. Hendricks' mother, who died at 86, wouldn't recognize her old home today. We will post additional information about the community of Wagner on our website at cmfmedia.org, where you'll be able to see pictures of the event and find helpful links to other sites relative to the topic. You'll also be able to listen to the extended interview with Mr. Hendricks.
In upcoming history features on Central Florida Matters, we'll be seeking stories about the unincorporated communities of Taintsville, Slavia, and Jamestown. So if you're a source of knowledge about one of those geographic areas in East Seminole County, click on the contact link on the CMF website and send us an email, won't you? We'll be in touch.
And leave a comment or email the feature to a friend, family member, or colleague if you believe they will have an interest in the history of our communities.
A feature of every Central Florida Matters is a 3-minute commentary presented by a voice that matters on an issue that voice believes matters. The voice you'll hear is that of Judy Duda, Chair of the Board of Trustees of Carroll McKinney Public Media, commenting on the issues and voices that matter to her.
On January 3, 1958, I arrived in Central Florida, a very young teacher, eager to begin my new career in Florida. What I saw as I stepped down to the tarmac and then into the tiny Orlando airport of that time would be shocking, I think, for anyone more recently transplanted to Florida. The sight of racially segregated restrooms and drinking fountains, unfortunately, was my first introduction to what life would be like in this place. Yes, I arrived here before civil rights legislation thankfully put an end to such things. I arrived here before Orlando sprouted its very first shopping mall. Goodness, I believe I arrived here even before Walt Disney. History was in the making all around me even then, of course. For the most part, I learned about the important issues by reading the Sentinel Star or from newscasts on the only 3 network TV stations that served our region. But I was young, of necessity immersed in my career, then my marriage, and raising a young family. Certainly there were many issues that mattered to me, but it was only a few years later, when my children had become a bit more independent, that I was able to widen my focus to include the greater community and to find time to become actively involved in helping to make Central Florida an even better place to live. For the past 40 years or so, I've been privileged to serve on the governing boards of many nonprofit organizations that benefit Central Florida in the areas of social services, education, cultural arts, and communications. During my decade-long service to WMFE, our local PBS and NPR affiliate, I was especially privileged to work with the then president and CEO of the stations, Stephen McKinney Steck, an individual I came to admire as an extremely competent leader in his own field of broadcasting, and perhaps more importantly, as a man of great integrity. I was intrigued to learn that, following his retirement from WMFE, Stephen McKinney Steck had invested his own substantial talent and resources in developing an innovational media platform for presenting issues and voices that matter to the people of Central Florida. and I was delighted to be invited to serve on the governing board for the new nonprofit foundation, which was set up to make this creative vision a reality. I'm proud to serve as the chair of the Board of Trustees of the Carol McKinney Foundation, and I invite you to join me in supporting the mission of CMF and also to regularly enjoy the rich programming that will be coming our way from now on. Oh, yes, a great deal has changed since I arrived in Orlando in 1958. Today, there are new issues and new voices which demand our attention. And thankfully, there's also a new media platform to keep us informed and, may I say, even entertained as we learn more about the issues and voices that matter to us. This is Judy Duda.
Central Florida Matters encourages you to post your own reaction to this commentary. Visit the commentary segment online at cmfmedia.org. Should you wish to be considered for a future commentary segment on Central Florida Matters, please click on the contact link to send us an email, which should include adequate information for us to understand your issues and to offer contact information to include your name, email address, and the daytime telephone number.
Central Florida Matters had production assistance from Mike Hominick and Abby Horner. The series is co-produced by Stephen McKinney Steck and me.
This edition of Central Florida Matters will remain online in whole and its various parts until Thursday, October 8, when a new edition will be posted.
Please subscribe to CMF's e-letter and blog, Issues and Voices, while visiting cmfmedia.org. While there, we eagerly encourage you to financially support the program mission of Carol McKinney Public Media by clicking on the support icons found throughout the site.
CMF is a nonprofit, publicly supported charity. Ample information about CMF's budget, governance, history, and future plans may be found in the transparency document drop-down section at the top of the homepage. Thanks for listening to Central Florida Matters. For Desta Horner, I'm Stephen McKinney Steck.
Central Florida Matters is a presentation of Carol McKinney Foundation for Public Media, Incorporated. Visit cmfmedia.org for more information.